So thanks a lot, Dr. Kumari, for this very kind introduction. And of course, thanks for inviting me and of course your colleagues at Quantum Foundations and Quantum Information Group here to present this colloquium today. And of course, I would like to take this opportunity to thank Perimeter Institute itself for hosting me and bearing with me for the last few days on the Simons Emmy Noether Fellowship, which has been a very nice experience. I have been able to renew old contacts, and his first trip abroad after, you know, after we all know, no one traveled for a long time now. So then this has been a lot of fun. And of course, new possibilities have emerged during the last couple of weeks. So thanks a lot. Well, of course, my association with Waterloo is much older than the Emmy Noether. I mean, you know, I'm probably, you know, one of those people who you've all seen around for, I don't know, greater than 15 years in different roles. But this is the first formal affiliation with PI. And I have other affiliations as well with other places in Canada. So, of course, you know, I our lab began in 2012. And so what I wanted to do over the next hour or so is give you a holistic overview of the kind of science that has excited me and our lab members for the last, you know, a few years. This is a colloquium, so I'll keep it at a general broad level. But of course, I'm very happy to discuss, you know, on specifics after the talk is over. So our journey began in 2012. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, and you can see some very, you know, I mean, sure, familiar faces from Canada who were also there to inaugurate my lab. And some of you may know the significance for the three ribbons in that picture. So we thought we wanted to cut three ribbons to symbolically represent three slits in some sense, because one of the experiments that I had done while I was at IQC was on testing the Born rule with three slits. And so that is the symbolism with Ray, Thomas, and Gregor being the three people cutting the three ribbons. And so since then, we have progressed a lot. And the idea is to share a little bit of our journey with you. Of course, you know, it goes without saying that, and I think I saw a very similar quote on the way out from PI, you know, next to the main door, where I think it says, today's theoretical physics is tomorrow's technology. I mean, of course, Perimeter Institute is of theoretical physics, and I do find myself a little bit of an odd person here, given that I actually work on experiments. But then, of course, you know, it is this marriage between fundamental science and applied technology, which sort of summarizes the work that quantum science and technology represents. And so while the quote may not be in the best of context, but it does definitely hold for a lot of what we do. And this is something we have tried to engage in consciously over the last several years. And in fact, when we started off in 2012, it wasn't really the most happening topic, let's say, in India. But then over the last couple or so years, it has really become a very interesting topic to many people. And with the government also, you know, promising resources towards this field, I think we have a lot of excitement coming up in the next few years in the quantum domain from our country. Well, having said that, you know, one of the things that our lab is particularly very interested in is actually in the fundamental science aspect of the problem. And of course, it is motivated by this rather bleak statement, which of course, you know, there are experts here who work on these ideas about, you know, the fact that the theoretical understanding of the universe itself is very incomplete. And we don't understand, you know, more than 80% of what it is made of. So in our, you know, limited way, we want to understand the principles of quantum mechanics better and see, you know, how far we can go with precision tests of various aspects of the field so that, you know, with these bounds, we can actually hope to have better technology emerge as well. And so we are consciously working on both these aspects in many of our explorations. And of course, the technological applications that we are particularly you know, invested in are quantum computing and quantum cryptography. And we deal with experimental as well as theoretical problems related to all these areas. And so that is what sort of sums up our you know, lab. So we have a quantum optics lab. It is a class 10,000 clean room. Now, of course, you know, at PI, I mean, you know, it's a relatively clean institute, I would say, and, you know, more so post-COVID, the, you know, health and safety things have really improved all over the world, right? But having said that, this is a room which has been, you know, sort of, we have worked with it to make it clean. And so it is less than 10,000 dust particles per cubic foot is the definition. And you know, so this is the first clean room at RRI, really. And so I had to write actually a 100-page document to motivate RRI to actually enable a clean room for us. And after that, I think some of my colleagues have benefited from that, and we have more clean rooms now at RRI. And so this is important because, you know, we do have a lot of dust in India. For people who have been to India, you know that, you know, we are a very vibrant, but also, you know, a little bit, we have dust and lots of different elements in the atmosphere, which are interesting. And so we want to modulate the environment, the temperature, the humidity, so that, you know, some of our experiments actually can be done with more precise control. And so this is what started off. And this is our lab website, which, of course, you know, has a lot more detail about what we do than what I will, of course, cover in the next few minutes, right? And as, I mean, you know, for every talk, I would like to, of course, begin by actually acknowledging the people who make the science happen. Of course, instruments are not very interesting if we don't have the right people working with them and making beautiful discoveries. And so these are the various people who are currently members of my lab. And there are different categories, students, postdocs, as well as engineers and visiting students, you know, who are adding to all the richness of the science that we are pursuing. And these are the former members who are in different places now, you know, working on different aspects of science and technology. And of course, I would thank my collaborators as well, because, you know, it's a field where collaborations are key. And I have named the Canadian ones in the beginning, given that I am at PI. And of course, Rafael Sorkin, who's promised to join on Zoom. It's much before his waking up time, but I'm very thankful if he has actually joined. And so, of course, he happens to be one of our collaborators for a long time now. And there are several others, of course. And of course, many people and many institutes in India. So we do believe a lot in crosstalk and discussions towards making things happen. And this is how Quantum Optics Labs looks. I mean, I think some of you, I see at least one experimentalist in the audience. And then, of course, there are, you know, others who have been there. And so these are all, you know, this is how it generally looks. And this is the entrance to a clean room, right? So you have to wear a special shoe and so on and so forth. So what we do, you know, so of course, you know, there are different approaches one can take towards working on quantum information, which is what, of course, we work on. We are working with light, and so single particles of light play a very important role. And so we are working with single and entangled photons in the lab. And, you know, we are the first lab to work with single and entangled photons in India and apply them to all these areas that we are going to discuss. And if people here in the audience are not particularly familiar with how to make photons, which could be the case given that we are at a theoretical institute, do have a look at this, you know, review where we have gone through different ways of making photons. It's not as simple as, you know, dimming down the light and going to the single level. You have to put in a lot more work than that. And so we have, you know, we are actually working on what is called a spontaneous parametric down conversion, which is a nonlinear optics technique. And so here you have the, you know, animation where you have a crystal, which has a very high nonlinear coefficient. And you can see a blue laser beam. Of course, it's all in animation. It's not the real picture, which hits it. And then you have these two photons which emerge and in the form of cones, really. Okay, and the cross-section of the cone being a circle, that is what ends up being visible on a very, of course, intensified camera. It is not visible otherwise. And so this, you know, intersection point that you see here, that is the point where we can harness entanglement from, because you do not know a priori which cone it belongs to. So if it belongs to the left cone, it could be horizontal, right cone could be vertical, but the intersection could be either H or V. So if one is H, the other is V, and vice versa. So we form the Bell state that way. And so this is an example of a type 2 SPDC cone, and this is a picture from our own lab. And, you know, so a lot of what we do relies on entanglement. So, you know, and there are different ways in which you can harness this entanglement through different SPDC processes. And, you know, given that I'm several thousand kilometers away, this is the best I can do for a lab tour. But then, you know, the idea would be to welcome you physically there. And so this is an example of how things look, you know, so that is your blue laser. And now we have all this optics, which is required to shape the beam, guide the beam. We won't go through the details, but this is your nonlinear crystal, that square that you see. And you know, it is sort of impinging on that. After that, the photons come out, you don't see them. Of course, you don't see single photons. The laser beam is very bright, so you can see it. But the photons that come out, you won't be able to see. And so they come out in a pair and then, you know, hit this beam splitter. And then, you know, they go to two different detectors. And of course, how would you then know that you have these single photons or pair of photons in the lab? So what we do is what is called a coincidence measurement. So if you measure one photon in one detector, the other one is definitely there on the other detector because they always come out in a pair. So what you do is measure the correlation between these two detections. And that correlation is what is called a coincidence or peak, you know. So that is, so if it's perfectly phase matched, then you will have the emergence of this coincidence peak, which is what, you know, is a very popular and useful way of characterizing these photon sources. So this is again an example of, you know, how you would know that you have this pair of photons, which is what forms the workhorse for a lot of what we do, right, in the lab. And so these are different arrangements. So now I'll basically spend 5 minutes in giving you a bird's eye overview of almost everything that we have done, and then zoom in to a few things which I think will be of relevance to the audience here, as well as the ones online, which have, there is a reason for picking them up as I'll go along and tell you. So of course, as I mentioned, fundamental tests of quantum mechanics is something we are very focused on. And so this is a series of work that we have done here, which is on, and the first one, the last one here is this experiment that I told you about, which I had done while I was at IQC as a postdoc, so which was the Born rule test. But then we have done a lot more work since, and we have come up with, correction term to the Sorkin parameter. And we have measured it experimentally as well. And so these are all, and so I'll talk a little bit about this in detail. On the right, you see some of our fundamental quantum optics experiments where, you know, this is your Hong-O-Mandel dip, which is supposed to be quintessential quantum optics. So you have a dip when you have, you know, perfect single photons. But then what we have shown in this paper here, that you can do this with classical pulses as well, with phase control. So sort of, you know, challenging the folklore about Hong-O-Mandel dip being only quantum. And so this is something interesting. And these two papers I will actually talk about a little bit as we go along, which is on state estimation and the Leggett-Garg inequality and its violation. Okay. Entanglement, as I mentioned, is one of the things we are very, very focused on. And so we have done a lot of work on entanglement. So here we have an entangled photon source, in fact, arguably the first entangled photon source in India. And this one, you know, has been used for several experiments. But then the recent one that we are working on is on manipulating the sudden death of entanglement. So entanglement is a resource. We are all familiar with that. But, you know, it interacts with the environment and decays. With time, there is decoherence which sets in. So what we have done is we've come up with a proposal to make this not happen or happen later. And so we are manipulating the sudden death of entanglement. And so the theory work is published. We are now almost done with the experiment as well. And so this will be a very nice proof of principle manipulation experiment, which can be then used by other solid state technologies as well. This is something which I'm sure is of interest to, and I know a few people in the audience who are interested in this problem. So we've done a lot of work in understanding weak measurements and weak interactions, which is, you know, as you know, also called generalized measurements. So essentially, as a tool to understand what happens to a system between preparation and measurement. So something which you don't conceive of in the Strong von Neumann sense, that, you know, you prepare something, then it evolves. You're not allowed to do much with it, because if you do something, then the state collapses. That is the common notion. But then if you do this weak interaction, you can actually gain information about what is happening between preparation and measurement in an ensemble sense. And so we have done some interesting work here on measuring the expectation value of a non-Hermitian operator, for instance, in the lab. And this work, which is currently under review, is the first unambiguous demonstration of the quantum Cheshire cat effect. Where we have been able to show the, you know, separation between the particle and its property jointly in a measurement. And, you know, if you have read fairy tales, you know the Cheshire cat, the cat without the grin and the grin without the cat. But then that is something which can be done experimentally. And this is something we have very recently accomplished. But then, you know, I won't say much details now, but hopefully in future visits, I can give more technical seminars on some of these topics, right? In quantum computing, as well as some aspects of quantum key distribution, we are actually working on an approach which is not qubit-based. So we are working on what is called higher dimensional quantum approaches. And so this is a series of work, and I will talk a little bit in detail about this later on. Okay. Quantum communications is, of course, one of our key areas, which is, sort of, as I said, one of the most technologically advanced areas in quantum quantum domain. And we are working on India's first project on satellite-based quantum key distribution, trying to demo, establish a key between faraway ground stations using a satellite as a trusted node. Quantum experiments with satellite technology, it is called. Integrated photonics-based approaches to QKD, which is completely the, I would say, the opposite end of the spectrum. Satellite-based approaches, people like us, we won't be able to afford to have a satellite for ourselves or something like that. It's a much bigger scope. So, you do this in a holistic way, and of course, you work towards establishing things. But if I want to actually use the advantage of QKD myself, maybe I want it in my cell phone, which I think we all can afford, even as physicists who don't earn a lot, but then we do have these resources. So that would be the thing of integrated photonics-based QKD. QKD for the common man is how I say this, when I give this talk to a non-physicist audience. But then, so this is the opposite end of the spectrum we are also working on. We're working on quantum teleportation, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, again, towards increasing the distance in communication using relays and repeater technologies. And a very recent thing that we have started is on device-independent random number generation, which is on, under the Center for Excellence grant that we have, where we are approaching random number generation using, inequalities other than Bell. In fact, we have a recent work, theoretical work, where we have shown how we can use the Hardy and Kebilolyang relations towards such, randomness generation. And we are also working on other inequalities, both theoretically and experimentally. So this is the general overview. Okay. And so I think, so this sort of is the broad spectrum of work that we are doing in our lab in different aspects. So what I wanted to do, to give coherence to the next aspect of this talk, is I wanted to sort of go from talking about two things which are very, very foundational or fundamental in their, sort of applicability, then move on to something where we have actually used a fundamental resource towards a technological application, which is quantum state estimation, and then end with something which will be more with the technology flavor. But of course, we are using quantum mechanics there as well. So sort of this is how I have planned to walk through some of the things so that, you can see us, make some sense of the type of stuff which we are doing. So we begin with something which is very recent, which is, as I mentioned, the Leggett-Garg experiment, and some fundamental quantum questions, which especially the students should have. I mean, while we, spend a lot of time and energy motivating people to work in quantum science and technology, sometimes this question does come up. These things that we study, they seem rather counterintuitive. I mean, we don't really tunnel through the wall. I mean, I have tried and it's not been pleasant. So these are things which don't happen naturally. So what do these non-classical features actually reveal about the nature of physical reality? I mean, ultimately, where are we with this? Does it all make sense? This kind of question students definitely ask, but I also ask, and I'm sure we all keep asking these questions, and that is what makes it interesting. So how do we reconcile our everyday experience of the macroscopic world, so to speak, which is what we belong to, let's say, with this weird, or quote unquote weird behavior of the microphysical world described by quantum mechanics? The fact that, Lucene is sitting here and hearing my talk, I'm sincerely hopeful that if I look that way, he won't take the opportunity and walk away. I mean, the fact that he's sitting here is perhaps going to remain true, irrespective of whether I look at him. And so this is an example of a measurement. And, we are used to things being independent of that. Property should exist independent of the measurement. But what happens in realism, or what happens, this is what is realism, right? That is not what happens in quantum. So the classical worldview that we all sort of condone to tells us that a system is in a definite state for which all its observable properties have definite values, independent of measurement, almost like the example that I just took. But unlike a classical state, the specification of a quantum state does not in general give the values of dynamical variables possessed by a system. So in general, a dynamical variable is taken to have no definite measurement independent value, which is kind of contrast to what we would hope for, right? In other words, a measurement according to quantum mechanics in general does not reveal a pre-existent value of a dynamical variable. So it could have one of many possibilities. When you measure, you know what is the property. That is what we do in quantum. And in fact, this also worried famous and very important people like Albert Einstein. As the quote is famously attributed to him, that he likes to think the moon is there even if I'm not looking at it, just like Lucian is there even if I'm not looking at him. And so this is something which is which makes sense for Albert Einstein to be worried about, and and of course lesser mortals. So this brings us actually to two key notions of this everyday world. So one of them is based on what we call local realism, which is what, of course, gives rise to these local realist inequalities. And of course, you need bipartite or multipartite systems to test these. For instance, the Bell type inequalities are an example. And so this is one domain where you can test this concept of realism. The other one is what is called macro realism, which with it macro realist inequalities and talks about single systems. So Bell inequalities and their violation, of course, famous experiments where you have these entangled photons or whatever, and they are at a certain distance and you measure things and you show the violation, and then you of course violate realism. But then what about a single system? A single system also, of course, can be a quantum system. Then how do you do something with the single system? A single system, in fact, like this cat, can be in a superposition state, right? So a single system can be in a superposition state of macroscopically distinct possibilities, and that is what is used in motivating what is called the Leggett-Garg inequality and its variance. And so that is what would be used to check on or test realism in a single system. Okay, so this is the distinction. So Bell inequality and its variance use realism and locality as their fundamental principles. The Leggett-Garg inequality and its variance use realism, of course, but they replace locality with what is called non-invasive measurability, which is a very difficult thing to do experimentally. So you're supposed to measure something without causing any invasiveness. And so, of course, which is what one needs to do these tests comprehensively. And so this is the difference, basically. So Bell Leggett-Garg inequality is in fact the temporal analog of the Bell inequality. So, in Bell, you have these systems which are separated in space. So you have the locality and non-locality and so on. In Leggett-Garg, you have a system which is evolving in time, and you measure the correlation between different, measurements in time. So it's a temporal analog. And of course, as I said, you have to have macroscopically separated available states and this non-invasive measurability. And so Leggett and Garg are the two people, of course, who came up with the Leggett-Garg inequality. And the original motivation of this inequality was to probe the possible limits of quantum mechanics for mesoscopic or macroscopic systems. So when you increase the size of a system, so to speak, how far does quantum mechanics hold? And that is, of course, an important question. The concept of tunneling, we don't see ourselves tunneling, but then if you increase the size, how far will you be able to see it and when will it break down? So this testing this classical quantum boundary, that has been one of the main motivations for Leggett-Garg traditionally. And these are all examples of experiments where this has been achieved. But then in recent years, this quantum mechanical violation of LGI and its implications have been extensively studied for various types of microsystems to probe their non-classicality. Because of course, if you violate the Leggett-Garg inequality, the system is definitely non-classical. And so solid state qubits, nuclear spins, electrons, photons, many such systems, one has performed this, and all this without involving the notion of locality, right? So this is the distinction. And so this is the experiment that we have recently done, which is on a loophole-free interferometric test of macrorealism using heralded single photons, okay? And key features of our experiment, because I won't go through the details here given the nature of the talk, this is the first loophole-free experiment where both the LGI and the Wigner form of the LGI have been decisively violated. Now, the Wigner form is something very, very specific, and some people would know this, but of course, we can discuss it later. This is a comprehensive refutation of the classical realist worldview, along with measurements which are ensured to be non-invasive. That was tricky. And also very importantly, this is important because if you can violate legged guard, and you can say that, okay, you know, we have disproven realism. But then what is the theory which explains your observations? So that is also important, because there could be one in many which sort of fit the bill. And what we have shown is that our experiment matches almost perfectly with quantum mechanical predictions. So we have actually also agreed with quantum mechanics as the theory which explains our experiment. That is important. And of course, the non-classicality of the single photon states, we can harness now, and you know, we can use it for various information theoretic applications, which of course we are doing anyway. But then this sort of sets the stage for that. Why is a loophole-free test important? What is a loophole? And I mean, you know, for people who are not from this particular sub area, you may not know what is a loophole. A loophole is something which kind of kills your experiment, in the sense that, you know, you spend all these years doing something, and then somebody comes in and says, oh, but this is something you didn't think of. So maybe this is the reason why you observe what you observe. And it's this loophole. You didn't quite think of this possibility. So there is some ambiguity in what you've done, which kind of explains what you've done. It's not really what you're saying. And so this is basically a very, popular level description of what is a loophole. And so loophole-free tests are important. And of course, the Bell experiments, you know, have been done for decades now. And the loophole-free tests only came in 2015. And, you know, there are three separate experiments in the same year which have claimed loophole-free tests of, the Bell inequality. So it took decades to actually reach loophole-free. And we are very happy that it's already July. I mean, when I gave the talk in June, I said it's already June, but now it's already July. And we don't have another claim for a loophole-free LGI this year still. So we definitely are comprehensively the first people and remain so. We have 6 more months though. But then, you know, we definitely would retain our claim for being the first. And it is important. And this is a great article. You know, if this is something which you've not really worked out, and I mean, you know, I have a colleague here who's from particle physics, so thanks for coming. So this is an article which, you know, you should read, because it kind of gives a very nice overview of these loophole-free Bell tests and tells you why it is important. It is important, of course, you know, by doing this, you're fulfilling the long-standing goal that, you know, you're proving something is real and complete, and you know, you are basically disproving something comprehensively, which is one thing. But then by doing this, you're also creating a system which can now be used, you know, for various things like perfectly secure QKD, random number generation, and so on. So now you have no ambiguity about the experimental architecture. So all these things can be done. And of course, done without any loophole as well. And so this is why loophole-free tests are important for, this field, not just from the fundamental perspective, but also the applied one. Okay. And so, as I said, we have actually violated both the LGI and WLGI comprehensively. It's necessary. So again, now this is the detail which I will skip, but then the idea is that both are necessary conditions for MR, but not sufficient. So doing them together gives you more confidence that, you have done this violation comprehensively. Okay. And our macroscopicity is of the order of 10 to the 4. And so this is defined by the distance between the two arms of our interferometer divided by the wavelength of the photon. Okay. And so this is actually very high. And this is a question that usually comes, so I'm answering it, in retrospect, so that we can have other questions. So you're dealing with a photon. Photon is massless. How are you claiming to do an LGI experiment? And of course, you know, it's a great question, but the answer to that is you do not need mass as the only parameter to define macroscopicity. So the macroscopicity is something which is a system dependent, context dependent, description. And so in our case, it's a length scale dependent problem. But in other systems like the SQUID one, the very popular one, because it has Leggett also in that work, right? So they have defined it, as basically the difference between magnetic moments, for instance. So it is a context dependent definition, and it does not require mass. So photon is a perfect candidate to do this, because for us, the aim was to establish this architecture for loophole-free tests, not so much to test the quantum classical boundary using mass, right? So we have chosen photons, and we have closed all these loopholes, which I'm sure some of you are aware of, for the first time. Okay, and the clumsiness loophole is something I have to talk about, because, you know, I'm talking to mostly theorists here, and, I have had the great experience of sometimes one or two theorists visit the lab and just touch the beam splitter and say, ah, this is nice. And the whole experiment has been misaligned for a few weeks. I won't name the theorist, but from my family, actually. So, you know, so this is something which we are very good at in this, I'm sure, in this institute, in terms of experimental clumsiness. But it actually is something similar, but it's a little bit more than that, right? So what is clumsiness loophole? Clumsiness loophole is essentially this, that, you know, when you are trying to do a measurement, inadvertently you will create some mark, right? So there is some invasiveness associated with a measurement, which is something you cannot avoid. And so this is what is called being clumsy. And so in these experiments, you know, that can be taken as an explanation for whatever you're observing, rather than, you know, basing it on what you're trying to measure. So this is something which is very important for Leggett-Garg, because we have to do this non-invasive measurability. And so one of the things which has been done early, and we have also done, is what is called a negative result measurement. These are great, what should I say, jargons, so to speak. And if I just went on saying this, even I, in the beginning, I was like, oh my God, there are so many different ideas which one has to converge on. But then when you go through them, you know, they actually make a lot of sense. So what is a negative result measurement? It's actually what it says. So I want to actually do the measurement here. Okay, you can see my mouse here. But the detector is here. So the detector is detecting things, but I'm only dealing with the ensemble which I'm not detecting. So that is the negative result. So I'm detecting in a place which is different from what I actually want to harness. And so this is what is called a negative result measurement. And it's obviously a very nice way of being non-invasive, because you're not even placing a detector to detect in that sub-ensemble of experiments. So this we have, of course, done. But we have actually done something more. And, you know, the detail I cannot go through here, because it's quite a bit of it. But then what we have done is we have also satisfied the two-time no signaling in time condition. So what is a no signaling in time? It is precisely no signaling in time, which means the choice of measurement at any instant does not affect the statistical results of any measurement at a later instant. And now you can see this obviously lends itself to non-invasive measurability. So if I'm doing something now and statistically I don't affect what is happening later, so obviously I'm not being invasive. But so we have actually painstakingly satisfied these NSIT conditions for all the two-time measurements we have done. And that way we have closed the loophole much more strongly than just the negative result measurement. And so this is something we are particularly very happy about. The second thing which we are very happy about is the detection efficiency loophole. For the people who work on Bell and Bell type work, you know the detection efficiency is something which comes in many calculations you do. So what is the critical detection efficiency beyond which you can call it loophole free? And what does that mean? That means that, you know, try as I may not, I will never have a detector which detects everything that falls on it. It's a technological problem. If I have 100 photons on a detector, maybe only 60 get detected or 65 get detected. Not everything will be detected. And that is something we have to live with. So what we say, we do the fair sampling assumption, which means we only talk about the ensemble which gets detected as a sample and go ahead with that. But then that is not enough. And so what, and it's difficult for LGI, because using hidden variable models, we have done this calculation to put a critical detection efficiency for our experiment. And it's quite high. We don't really have these detectors in the lab as of now. So we went on to do something else. So we actually did two things here. One is we replaced the detector in T2 here with a perfect blocker. Okay. So we are doing negative result measurements. So we actually care about this part, let's say. So the other part, instead of a detector, I put something which is a perfect metal blocker. And perfect, I can actually characterize. So perfect means that it doesn't allow any extra photon to go through, which we have characterized in separate experiments. So it's 100% detector. So I can have actually 100% efficiency detector, except that I'm not really caring about what I'm detecting, so I'm blocking everything. So that is one trick, I would say. And the other trick, which is not quite a trick, it involved a lot of math, is we pushed all the detection to the time T3. And you know, as a result of which, this eta parameter, which is the efficiency, it just comes out as a denominator in the problem. And so any non-zero value is enough. Otherwise, it'll blow up. So anything greater than zero was enough for our experiment. And so we have actually made the detection efficiency loophole irrelevant in this context. And that is how we have circumvented it altogether instead of trying to close it by using an 85% efficiency detector, which we did not have, we have actually made it irrelevant, which I think is one of the USPs of this experiment. We have also closed other loopholes like the multi-photon emission loophole. This is an actual schematic. Many people have worked on clumsiness loophole before, but the others have not garnered much attention so far in the LGI thing. And detection efficiency, particularly, is something we are very happy to have closed. And so these are our results. And so you can see, you know, the experimentally measured. So for people who are uninitiated, the macro realist upper bound for LGI is 1. And so we have measured 1.32, as you can see, plus minus 0.04. So we are 8 times the standard deviation from what macro realism tells you. So we are very, very strongly violating that. And for the WLGI, it is 5 times the standard deviation. This is the quantum mechanical prediction, which actually took several months, because it's not just about the quantum mechanical prediction. It's actually taking into account all the non-idealities of your experiment and modifying the quantum mechanical expectation according to that. And so we now have this expectation from quantum mechanics with our experimental parameters. And you can see this matches. I mean, I have not seen such a perfect match in an experiment before. So I'm particularly pleased, because it happened, you know, not because of us doing anything. It just does fall perfectly within the range. Okay, and the NSITs have also been, established very comprehensively as well. So this is our result, and this is us with Tony Leggett. And in fact, Rafael was also visiting at that time. So we celebrated Tony's 80th birthday 3 years ago. And he happened to be visiting, and we had some nice discussions with him on this, at that time, ongoing experiment. And so that was very enriching. And we are also very pleased that, you know, different scientific portals picked up on our experiment and wrote about it for people beyond our community, right? And the New Scientist one is particularly interesting, because it calls it the most watertight experiment of all time. So, you know, at least New Scientist likes us very much. So so that is the first part, which is the the fundamental thing I wanted to say. The next part is something I really wanted to include a little bit, because this was my last talk at PI in this higher order interference conference that happened, you know, in 2016, I believe, or something like that. And so we've done a lot of, you know, work in this domain on higher order interference and Born rule. And so brings us to our favorite, system, which is a slit-based system. So this is a double slit system. And so the question that we ask in this is that, you know, if I have a double slit given to me, and I have a source and I have a detector, what would be the solution to the wave equation? It could be anything. Maxwell's equation, could be Schrodinger equation, depends on your system of choice. But what is the solution? And of course, the answer is, usually what we tend to do is we say that, you know, the solution is simply a sum of the two solutions when we close the slits individually. So if we close B, have A open, solution is psi A. Close A, open B, solution is psi B. And then if you open both, then the solution is psi A plus psi B. That is what we are used to using, you know, and V as in many people before us. But then there is a problem with this. The problem is, of course, that, you know, it's not the same boundary condition. So by opening them individually and opening them together, we are actually posing different boundary conditions to your equation. So is there someone else speaking with me? Yeah. Okay, there is some background. But then there are different boundary conditions. So then this should not really be true. So there should be a correction term to this. And, you know, people before us have also thought about this in the path integral perspective. And, you know, the correction will come from terms like this, which are the subdominant paths, right? But this calculation that was done by Yabuki et al. Was very theoretical in its scope. Like, you know, ideal point slits, things of Planck length, which of course you cannot do experimentally. You know, such things can never happen. And so if I work on any theory, it has to be something which I can also see an experiment come out of it if I don't do it myself. And so this was a little too idealistic in its mindset, but it did motivate our work. And of course, the all possible paths being the key feature here. And so this was the first experiment that I mentioned, which I did while I was already in Waterloo, on using a triple slit structure to test Born rule. But then we went on to do this work in 2014 after I went back. And this is where we actually proposed how we can, quantify these classically subdominant paths, or non-classical paths, as we called it in quantum interference experiments. And, followed it up with an analytic bound on this contribution as well. And we also were working on the experiment. And parallel to us, we had the Boyd group also work on an experiment where they, you know, claim to see these exotic loop trajectories of photons in three-slit interference. they used this system where they had a system with a gold film and you know, slits etched on it, and they used the surface plasmon effect to enhance their Sorkin parameter contribution. So it wasn't really a geometric contribution, it was a material dependent one, but nonetheless they saw an enhancement, and this was their result. And you can see the Sorkin parameter is a function of detector position. So these blue dots here, these are your experimental data points. The blue line is the simulation that they did following our theory. And of course, you know, now I'm talking to the right people here, because we have mathematicians and theoretical physicists. You should be able to come up with a better fit for these blue points than calling this the best possible fit. Because of course, you know, these points are pretty much at the minima. We don't have any experiment at the maxima or in the slope. So this is only that. And I could fit it with a parabola, for instance, if I really wanted to. So we could do better than this, you know. I mean, of course, it's a great experiment, but we went on to actually do better. And so this is our results of the Sorkin parameter as a function of detector position. And you can see we have data points at peaks, tips, and slope, which is how it should be. Otherwise, you know, you have all possible matches. And so this is our theoretical, band, including all the errors and so on. And we did, of course, this was the first experiment I did when I went back to India. And of course, I had to do a precision experiment in an open field just to prove a point, right? You know, that is how you begin. Instead of doing something in the lab, you go out in an open field, use antennas as sources and detectors, and go to the microwave domain and do an experiment, which of course is perfectly fine, because of course Feynman path integral is not just applicable to quantum, it's equally applicable to classical. So we use electromagnetic waves and increased our Sorkin parameter to 10 to the minus 2. And we could tune this experiment, you know, we could sort of see the effect come in and out. So when you put the blocks in the path of the slits, then, you know, this effect disappeared. So we knew that we were definitely measuring the kappa parameter. And so this was a very nice work that we're very happy about. And of course, there were some other people who also were happy about this work. And very recently, we have done this. You know, we've actually measured the Sorkin parameter and the Peres parameter, which, you know, is something which some of you may know. The Peres test is something which tests the underlying mathematical structure of quantum mechanics, whether it's real, complex, or quaternionic. And so we have done both the Sorkin test and the Peres test on a quantum computer, a superconducting quantum computer, and shown how well we can test these principles using quantum computing. And now we are working on something where we're using these principles as benchmarks to benchmark the errors in quantum computers. And that is, I think, very interesting, because, you know, these NISQ era devices, ultimately, they are not really going to break our security as of now. So what are they useful for? How error prone are they? And so we are using fundamental postulates of quantum mechanics to benchmark them, which is something we are currently writing up, and I'm hoping I'll talk about it in some other forum. And people were excited by this development as well. So going on to the next 5 minutes, I'll talk about our approach to quantum computing, which, as I mentioned, is different from what usually we do, which is using higher dimensional systems, actually. And so qubit has two states. You all know this. A qubit is something which has three states and so on. So you can have a qubit for n greater than 2, you can define. And this is one way of generating a qubit. You have a single photon incident on a system of apertures. Then you can define a superposition between the spatial degrees of freedom of this photon, okay? And it is very interesting in quantum computing, for instance, because you can have access to the same dimensionality of the state space by a smaller number of systems. So 2 to the 50 is similar to 3 to the 33 and so on. So if you increase the base, you have the exponent draw, which is great, because all of us have been struggling really to increase the number of qubits in coherent superposition. So this is the, you know, one of the ways to motivate studying higher dimensions. But what we went on to do is find a new way of generating these qubits, where you saw my down conversion video. So if you remember a little bit, the idea is that instead of actually pumping the crystal with a Gaussian beam, we pump it with a beam which already has a structure, the spatial structure ingrained in it. So the photons that come out also have this ingrained in them. And so we actually went on to, this is our experiment. And so just like you can transfer the Gaussian profile to the single photons, you can also transfer such spatial structures to the single photons. And this is the you know, the pump, and this is the single photon at the detector. And we went on to see very nice 1-1, 2-2, 3-3 correlations. So we have a pair of Q-trits, spatial Q-trits in the lab, which have been generated using this pump beam modulation technique, which actually are nearly maximally entangled. Now, question is, when you look at this correlation, this is a statistical correlation measure, how did we actually know whether it's a quantum correlation or not? Because, you know, you could have perfectly correlated classical systems. So this is something which we have done very recently, where we have actually measured the amount of entanglement that these Q-trits share, and not done the usual standard tomography technique, which is popular, but then it has a very bad scaling with D square, you know, it scales with dimension. So we have actually come up with a way in which we have related statistical correlation measures and measures of entanglement through monotonic relations. And so this is the pure state, and this is the mixed state. And so this is an experiment where we have done the first direct measurement of this entanglement monotone without doing tomography, but exact amount of entanglement, not just, you know, these bounds that are very popular. It's not an entanglement witness. It is actually a quantification of the amount of entanglement. And so this is a new way of doing this. And we have also shown the non-equivalence of these entanglement measures in higher dimensions. And so we are working on different, you know, protocols using now this system that we have established in different domains in computing and otherwise. Okay, and for students, you can have a look at this popular level, you know, this invited article that I wrote in Scientific American, which is actually on this higher dimensional approaches that our lab is working on. Moving on to this, usage of something fundamental towards something which is applied. This is an experiment that I chose to pick up because, you know, it does this very well. It actually works on a new way of estimating the quantum state by using interference as a tool. Interference is as fundamental as it gets, right? Like, we begin with Young's double slit experiment when we start studying quantum mechanics. So using interference to do something which is quite applied, you know, to estimate the state. But why would you want to estimate the state? Well, of course, that is what is used to describe a system, and it's central to quantum theory. And of course, you know, in theory, of course, we can always assume a form of the wave function and do our calculations. But in experiment, we can't just assume, because we need to know how error-prone the initial state is, because everything beyond that will be affected by this error, right? So this is, we can't just assume and go ahead like in theory we can. And so we, of course, you know, if we know the density matrix, we can calculate entanglement entropy. And so there are many, many reasons why state estimation is an important problem. And we have come up with a new way of doing this, which is called quantum state interferography. So you can see we have modified the word tomography to make it applicable to our method, which is using interference, which is, of course, as fundamental as it gets. So this is the central question. Can we have a device with which, without any change of internal settings by the user, we can determine the quantum state of the system? Okay. And in fact, this is the answer. And, you know, this is a single shot quantum state estimation tool. This is how it looks, you know, the schematic. And what we have shown in the paper, we have, of course, shown the proof of principle experiment using qubits, and we have 98 to 99% fidelity for pure states and around 96, 97% fidelity for mixed states. But we have also shown how you can use this for estimating the quantum state of a higher dimensional system. And instead of using d square minus one measurements, which is what you would use for tomography, we use d minus one measurements. So the scaling advantage is very nice. From square, you know, you go down straight to the linear scaling, which is the best scaling you can have. And of course, for 2D, it just becomes one measurement, right? D minus one, two minus one is one. So, and we have also shown how you can use this to quantify entanglement, again, using much less number of measurements. So this is, you know, interference, something we love and like, and, you know, have been using for a while towards a problem, which in fact, now we are discussing with companies to commercialize, you know, to make a pocket-sized quantum state estimation device, which, you know, you can just use on the go. And in fact, this is something we are currently even investigating with other people. Finally, I go on to quantum communication, which, as I said, you know, I'm going, as you can see, in from fundamental foundational aspects towards more applied areas. And this, of course, I say is, you know, the most quote-unquote practical quantum technology, because we also have companies which are making products. And so, you know, there's a lot happening in this domain, which, you know, is taking it from the research domain to product domain and so on. But there is, of course, a lot to be done from the research perspective. And in this, the most quantum aspect is quantum key distribution, okay? So why you should worry about it? I mean, you know, and that's the question we should ask ourselves anyway, right? Like when we do something, why exactly should I worry about it? I think it's a great question to begin any experiment with. But then having said that, in this, why you should worry, even if you don't do the experiments, but then if you do any of these four things, if you're buying things with a credit card, if you're buying things online, I think we are buying things online mostly now, you know, given the last 2.5 years. So these are all examples of, you know, activities we do, which require a level of security, which doesn't is not required for, you know, things like this, where I'm talking to you. I don't mind if someone else comes in and listens. And of course, people are on Zoom. But then if I were to give you my bank details, I would sincerely hope that it doesn't make its way to a third party. Whatever amount I may have in the bank doesn't matter, but then it is a means of strategic communication. So strategic communication is something we are all interested in. And so far it has been done through what is called classical cryptography. So you have a system, you know, you have a user, he or she encrypts the message using a key, and then the receiver also has the key, does the decryption, and you have you know, a solution there. But then many of these techniques are at a risk of being compromised through quantum computers. And so we need a solution come up from the quantum space, which is quantum cryptography. So what is wrong or what is limited about classical cryptography is that unconditional security is not possible. For instance, this protocol, which is very popularly used, the RSA protocol, it is based on the mathematical complexity of factoring large numbers, which we all know, you know, 3 times 7 is 21. It's a simple problem. But if I tell you what are the prime factors of 113471, I don't think you can just say that. It's a harder problem. So that is what it is based on. But then Shor's algorithm, this is Peter Shor, by the way, his algorithm can use quantum gates and can change the hardness of the factorization problem to something much simpler. And it can then be done in real time. So computational resources grow very fast. And today's hard problem could be solved tomorrow using brute force attack. There could be new algorithms for classical computers. And, you know, we have geniuses all around, right? I mean, I'm not one of them, but then it's mostly in the 14 to 19 category that the geniuses come about, right? Who say, okay, I have this now new algorithm to do something which yesterday was impossible. That can happen with factorization because there is no reason, there is no theoretical proof of its hardness. It is just hard because we haven't really been able to crack it. And of course, quantum computers themselves will run Shor's algorithm. So my security should be independent of future advancements in computational power, new algorithms or new technology. That is, it should be future secure. Okay, and so this brings forth the need for quantum cryptography, where security is based on laws of nature or laws of physics, so to speak, and not on mathematical complexity of large numbers or of a problem. Yeah, so that is why QKD is important. But I would like to definitely say this, that, you know, Krista from Microsoft Research sort of says this statement that it would take, something would take 1 billion years with a classical computer. A quantum computer could do it in 100 seconds. But this is the disclaimer that, you know, a quantum computer will employ Shor's algorithm to solve this. And it is estimated that, you know, it can be broken using 4,000 qubits and 100 million gates. And we are not quite there yet in terms of the quantum computer. But that doesn't mean that we just sit and, you know, not worry about it, because the research is going very, very rapidly in that domain. So we need to make ourselves ready. And QKD is one possible solution towards such readiness. Okay, and so that's why we should work on it today rather than tomorrow. And as I mentioned, we have different projects in the communication space at RRI. We have done, of course, different types of QKD protocols, as we should be doing. So prepare and measure-based approaches, which are based on uncertainty principle as their guiding factor. And this is a very interesting experiment we did a couple of years, 3 years ago, which is a modification of a protocol, but making it more secure and give us a bigger, you know, larger key rate. Okay, and so to our knowledge, till date, using SPDC, this was the result. And so we went on to get 50 kilobits per second and a qubit less than 4.8. So for the uninitiated, this is a good thing. And for the initiated, of course, it's also a good thing. And so this is what we had. And this we're very, very happy about, because we spent a lot of time in coming up with strategies to limit the qubit to below 4.8, which is the information theoretic security threshold. And you know, these are the numbers we went on to achieve. Entanglement-based protocols using, you know, different sorts of entanglement. This is a BBM-92 experiment, for instance, from the lab. And again, you know, this precision thing goes on with us. So we want to achieve something to a very high precision level. So the concurrence, we went up to 0.995, where the best is 1, which is, of course, as good as you can be. And so this is a paper which I won't do any justice to in the next 1 minute or so that I'll be speaking. But then this is a very interesting one, I would say, where, you know, we of course have done these lots of, you know, advancements towards having a higher key rate and lower Cuba. But also for India, it is important because it's the first reported end-to-end free space QKD experiment, which has been published in an internationally peer-reviewed journal. And that is very important to carry on with making contributions which are, peer-reviewed and sort of recognized in that forum, right? And we also went on to become software developers. So starting from LGI, going on to software development, I think, you know, it's a spectrum that I'm kind of giving you a glimpse of. And this is very interesting. What we went on to do is develop a software which takes into account all the, device and process imperfections that can affect QKD. And we also have a patent application on that now. So there are many simulation toolkits available for simulating QKD. But they don't quite, I mean, I think the problem is that they're not developed by people like us who actually do the experiment also. So software developers don't worry about a beam splitter not being 50-50, for instance. So what we do, because that affects our key rate and Q-bar. So all these imperfections we've taken into account and come up with what is called QKD sim, which is something we are actually going on to making new iterations of. And it was actually recognized by both the popular media, by the industry, as well as, popular science platforms. So something that we are continuing to do. And of course, our aim is to culminate in long distance quantum communications. And this is from Isaac Asimov even, that today's science fiction is tomorrow's science fact. And this is very true for us. You know, when we first proposed that we wanted to work on satellite QKD in 2013, it was treated as science fiction by several agencies who matter, who would give us some funding to do that. And it's never going to happen. And then a neighboring country went on to, launch a satellite in this aspect. And suddenly our science fiction became a science fact, and we got funding very quickly after that to start the first project on satellite-based QKD. So we do recognize that contribution that neighbors have towards this. And so, of course, why do we need such things? Because, you and I, communicating with each other using QKD is not as interesting as, let's say, countries which want to communicate with each other and, in a strategic platform. So we want to increase the distance, but you can't just do it just like that. Because if you're doing this through free space, you don't have line of sight beyond a certain distance. You don't see each other. You can do this through fibers, but fibers can't, you can't use the classical, repeater technology because you violate no cloning theorem. You can't just boost up your signal. So you have to do something out of the box. And so literally out of the box, use a satellite. That is one approach. And the other is using relays and repeaters and quantum memories. Okay. And so this is the idea that a satellite is going to spend some time on top of one of the ground stations, exchange some information, some key. It is then going to, it's going to revolve. It's going to go to some other ground station, maybe in Canada, let's say, exchange a key. And using certain operations, Canada and India can then be linked using a quantum link where we don't have line of sight. And of course, it's thousands of kilometers. So this is the general idea. And, this is what we are all working towards, this global quantum communication network. This is the satellite part. But then once this long distance is sorted, this key will then be, given to various service providers, banks, hospitals, et cetera, using fiber network. So we will combine satellite and fiber and go towards connecting up the whole globe, really, using quantum communication. That is what is the big dream. And we are working on different aspects of that, right, as a community. Different countries are doing different things in this domain. We are working in collaboration with our space agency since 2017 on quantum experiments with satellite technology. And of course, as I said, the idea ultimately is to have this secure communication between two regions, which are separated by thousands of kilometers using a satellite as a trusted node. These are our portable ground stations at RRI, actually. This is the one. And so here you can see that, we have Alice and Bob. That's what we call them. This is our lab. And this is another lab that we have. So we have established free space communication in January 2021. So this is very important to do this in free space. Of course, within the lab is one thing, but you have to go outside the lab, of course, to start increasing the complexity, because only then, you know, things like the atmosphere and all these things you can start accounting for. And so this is going to be increased, you know, the distance is going to be increased, and finally it'll have a satellite playing a role. So I'll skip the video, but then this is generally the video for this project. Okay, and again, you know, that was again a very important milestone for us as a country, where we were able to show this free space. This is in Hindi, by the way, free space communication between buildings, which sort of is the stepping stone towards the longer distances, right? And we got a, you know, a lot of appreciation for this. And in fact, what we are very happy about is, you know, our main science agency is the Department of Science and Technology, and it called us one of the 20 major success stories of 2020, not just in quantum, you know, it's across science and technology. So both this state estimation work and our QKD experiment were, you know, recognized by DST, which of course is very nice for us, motivates us further. And India Science Channel also recognized us as one of the top 10 inventions of 2020. And personally, I'm very pleased that I was awarded this award for women in cyber. But of course, what I want to go towards is a world where, you know, we can actually have recognitions which are gender unbiased in some sense. So, you know, that is what I would like to move towards. But then it's still, I mean, regardless of what gender we represent, it's good to be recognized. And it just motivates you to further, you know, put in all the effort towards diverse directions that I'm working on, and especially for the members of the lab who really are currently even perhaps taking some data while I'm here talking to you. So with that, I would like to thank you. So we've just finished 10 years of our lab, and of course we had to cut a cake to celebrate that in March 2022. And so I would definitely encourage people who are listening to me, of course, I mean, not Lucy and perhaps, but then, you know, the younger people perhaps, to think of joining us in different capacities, whether in PhD, postdoc, or in engineering roles. One thing I want to just tell you, it's a little bit, I mean, of course, with a bit of humor, that, you know, if you just went and checked out the salaries, for instance, and did a straight Google conversion, you won't be very pleased with what salaries in India convert to in dollar. But then let me also assure you that we have a very, very, you know, we also don't spend much. I mean, so we also, things are cheaper. So it's also, you know, so I have been a postdoc in Canada for 5 years. So I can definitely tell you that it's not particularly bad. So you might think, oh, you know, I'm going to be left with nothing. But of course, you're going to be in a country which has a lot more color, you know, compared to Canada, let's say, a lot more people. You'll actually see people when you look out the window. Here, of course, it's amazing. I mean, you know, you could just get lost in 3-day long weekend. And of course, I'm hoping that you are encouraged by the diversity of the science that we are doing, which we would be very happy to welcome you in different capacities, even as visitors, of course. So with that, I would like to thank you. And Meenu, I think I'm almost on time. Thanks. Mm-hmm. You're going to
also on Zoom, like if anyone has any questions, you can unmute yourself and ask.
Do you want to use that? That's a very weird, very interesting mic. Yeah.
So I wanted to understand a bit better the interferometric tomography. I'm not going to try and pronounce the word.
Quantum state interferography.
Interferography. Okay. Yeah. So you said at one point it was linear. Could you explain what that means? Is linear in the dimension, the number of measurements is linear in the dimension of the Hilbert space, or what did you mean by that?
Just give me a moment, because I actually have a slide which I didn't include, which kind of makes it very clear. Of course, I'm showing everyone my beautiful desktop, but. Is the talk I gave last week at QNC, so which had a lot more detail. So this is the one, Lucien. Yeah, so essentially what it means is that, you know, if you do tomography, then of course you need d square minus one number of measurements, right? So if you increase the d, that is how it would go up, the number. But what we have been able to show that by using d minus one measurements, we are actually able to estimate the quantum state. And what this means is that we are actually measuring d minus one interference patterns, or interferograms, as we call them. So this, so we are economizing on the number of measurements, but then before you ask the question that, you know, how is it possible that, you know, you can actually reduce the number and so on. And this is for, you know, this D minus one is for pure states.
Pure states, okay.
Yeah. So for the pure state, the record so far was 5 D minus seven. In fact, Bay, Zing and collaborators, they worked on this. So this is now D minus one, which is better. So you're measuring an interference pattern. And from that interference pattern, you're actually able to, you know, estimate these three quantities, which just bear with me. Yeah, these three quantities, which is the, you know, the phase shift, the average intensity, and the visibility. So once you measure the interference pattern, you can actually estimate these quantities. And so when you estimate these quantities, they actually come here in this form. So this is your intensity as a function of phase or, you know, distance. So these three parameters which you see here are populate this interference. So you can extract them. And by using these three parameters, you can then, you know, estimate the state. And again, the form, this is how it is. So these are the parameters that as they enter the density matrix. So these are the three parameters which you can extract from your interference pattern. So what we do is we have more post-processing in our scheme, as opposed to, let's say, in tomography, where you have many more measurements. So you're doing all these projections and reconstructing the state. In our case, we are doing only D minus one measurements, but we are extracting more quantities from each interference pattern, as a result of which we are able to reconstruct the state. And this is better for us because, you know, more measurements, each measurement brings an error contribution. Yeah. So by economizing on the number of measurements, we can be more precise. Because post-processing is, of course, you know, doesn't bring in any more errors into your from the experimental architecture itself. So this is the idea.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, I just went to a different talk altogether. Yeah.
Thanks very much for the very interesting talk and happy belated birthday to the lab. I had a follow-up question on
this one?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering if that the number of different measurements you need to do somehow affects the number of shots that you need to take in total to estimate the state we're given at.
Yeah, so I mean, in fact, that is the point, right? So we have to do less number of measurements in our case than what tomography would entail. So you have to do all these projections, right? So each of them is a measurement. Here, we are measuring the interference pattern, but then remember, and again, this is perhaps related to this question that when you measure an interference pattern, of course, you cannot generate an interference pattern with one photon. You have to have a significant number of photons to generate that pattern. But you also cannot, you know, measure the projection, you know, the projection measurement that you do, also you won't be able to do this with one photon. You will have to have statistics there also. So it's not like you need more statistics here and less there. That is perhaps where you're getting at. So it's number of shots, so to speak, that is required is not necessarily more here. Because, you know, you require, let's say, a million photons to have a nice contrast for your pattern. You will again require a similar number for all your HH, VV, H, whatever projections you're doing. So you cannot avoid using more than one. But of course, what we would do is we would use the assumption, not just we, it's for most experiments of concern, that, you know, the photons that are produced from the source are identical. So you can use many of them in an ensemble sense and generate the statistics for your experiment that is not particular to this experiment. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Questions? Yeah.
And for pure states in interferography,
yeah,
scaling is D minus one.
Yeah.
Is it possible to do it for mixed state? And
yeah, well, of course, you know, I mean, when we did this, we weren't successful in doing this for mixed states. But then, you know, we are still in the process of trying. We've not given up. But at that point, it did not seem like it was a natural thing that came out of our math. So we, our D, you know, the scale, the D dependent thing is pure state. But then, of course, you know, the for the qubit, we can do this for pure and mixed. Oh, qubit is just D minus one, which is one.
Right. Even for
so it's the same. D minus one holds, but for qubit, we are able to, you know, extract both pure and mixed. But for qudits, we have restricted to pure as of now. Yeah.
So while talking about computation of measurement of entanglement, without quantum state tomography, we can do that.
But yes.
I was wondering, is quantum state interferography there? Or
quantum state interferography also, we have shown how you can measure the entanglement of a bipartite qubit state in the paper. But then for higher dimension, we have not yet shown using quantum state interferography. That is a different approach where we have actually related entanglement monotones with statistical measures of entanglement. And that is an analytic calculation that we have done. So we can just do measurements in a mutually unbiased basis. So it's essentially one pair of measurements that is enough to extract the amount of entanglement. So that we have shown for pure and mixed. So that is extended to mixed as well. Whereas QSI, we haven't done it for mixed yet. Yeah. Thanks, Minu. Yeah. Yeah. No, actually, it's not just there. So, I mean, you know, each point on each cone actually has a correlated pair in the other cone. So it is only at the overlap point we actually have entangled. Yes, so I mean, that's a very good question. So it depends on the kind of source that one is looking at. So for instance, you know, if you have a HV minus VH type state that is type two, then of course it is easy to separate them by using a polarizing beam splitter for it. I mean, you know, you can have some, the H go one way and the V can go the other way because a polarizing beam splitter actually transmits H and reflects V. But then you don't know which one is which. So, you know, you'll have some possibility for H and some for V. And so you don't lose the entanglement, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you don't bring in distinguishability, if that is what you're thinking about. No. No, but then, of course, you see, you are always, you know, you always have some, so you're projecting, right? So you always, when you have one going to H, then only the other one will go. So it's two photons, which, anyway, show this to you with the picture because I've now gone to a different presentation, right? So let me go back to the original one, which is, it's just last week. So it was, it's not so impressive actually. So this is the cone. So maybe I'll show you the sudden death. Is my sudden death thing. So this is an example. As you can see, I mean, can you see? I mean, so this is, I mean, you know, this has the schematic in some sense of the source. So this is the crystal. So this is actually a type one sandwich source. Okay. So it gives you the HH minus VV state. This particular example here. So then these two photons, you know, one is coming here, one is coming, you don't see the photons anymore. So now they are on different paths, right? So this is a non-collinear geometry, it's called. So if they are on different paths, then of course, you know, they are measured differently. If they are on the, if you do the collinear geometry, which is when both of them are on the same path, then you can actually split using a beam splitter. But then you will not know which is going where in some sense. If one is H, the other is V, and if one is V, the other is H. So you actually retain that superposition. One thing you should not do is, you know, bring in some sort of a path difference. So one thing inadvertently one can do is that, you know, maybe one of the photons traverses a longer path than the other, then you bring in distinguishability, which of course reduces the entanglement. So the example, this source that I showed you for the QKD, that one is a, just bear with me, it's, there's a lot of slides now that I see. It's good that you actually listen to all of them, huh? So just one moment. of towards the end, isn't it, the QKD stuff. Now, I just wanted to show you the geometry because, you know, your question is well answered there. So this is an example of, what is called the Sagnac geometry. So here you can see, this is the crystal, right? So it gives rise to one clockwise propagating beam and the other is an anti-clockwise propagating beam. So both of them meet at this PBS here, okay? And so, of course, you know, once they meet at the PBS, then you do not know which beam comes from which direction. So if it is H, so the PBS is going to transmit H, reflect V, and transmit H this way and reflect the V the other way. So if it's HV, then, you know, it transmits this way and reflects this way. If it's VH, then it transmits this way and reflects the other way. So it goes through both. And this is a closed loop geometry. So there is no path difference introduced, right? So both the photons, you know, both the possibilities, they traverse the same path, one clockwise and the other anti-clockwise. And so the PBS actually just splits them into two, but then with equal probability for both. But that is why this alignment is quite tricky, because inadvertently you can bring in a little bit of, so if the mirrors are not perfectly, you know, aligned, then you can have a little bit of a longer path here, let's say, than here, and that shows up in a lower visibility for your, you know, the entanglement that you find. So you, of course, have to work your way up. So you start from zero and then all the way to 90, whatever. So this alignment plays a crucial role, and it has to be perfectly the same length for both, you know, clockwise and anti-clockwise. You get what I mean? Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, so this is, and this is a particular geometry, and so this is for the HV minus VH. The other one that, and so as you can see, this one is collinear in the sense that both the photons, they ultimately travel the same path. Whereas in the other one, it's the traditional cone, which is, you know, non-collinear. So you can have many possibilities, but yeah. You're welcome. Yeah. What medium of transmission it's? So I think it means what is the wavelength of the photon that is getting transmitted, but because of course the medium is atmosphere, so there's not much. So the wavelength is infrared. Yeah, but LED, I'm a little confused by the choices being infrared and LED, because LED is of course a light emitting diode, which is something else. We are using SPDC based sources and entangled sources in the infrared domain. Thank you. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that is the tricky one, right? Because of course, so that is, that's a very good question, because you see, ideally, you would always have invasiveness associated with measurements, right? So somehow you have to be able to distinguish between this invasiveness and, so there is a classical invasiveness, which is essentially just us doing things in a clumsy way, so to speak. And then there is something beyond that, which is basically invasiveness in the quantum domain. So the classical one is what we need to limit, of course, because those are the errors, right? And so now what we do in this is, so that is the error bound. So we shouldn't get confused between that and what we mean by NIM. In NIM, we are actually trying to limit the invasiveness that is inherent to a measurement, irrespective of our classical errors, okay? And so we are doing what we call negative result measurement. I think I mentioned that. The idea being that we are measuring in a subspace, which is different from the subspace, which is actually contributing to the inequalities. So in fact, if you have two arms of an interferometer, we are measuring in one of the arms, and the photons which don't go through that arm finally contribute to the joint measurements that we are doing. So that is, of course, something easy to see why it would be non-invasive, because we are not even putting any measuring device in the path of the photons which contribute to my final inequality. So that is the negative result measurement. That is something which has been done by others also, and we have also done that. But then, as I mentioned, we went a step further. We also sort of satisfied what is called this no signaling in time, which is a statistical equality in some sense, where by satisfying that has been shown to be mathematically equivalent to NIM. So this is a statistical equivalence of NIM. So we also done that so that it is even more comprehensive than just NRM, which has been done before. So I hope I made some sense. Okay. Okay. So Li-Fi transmission he's talking about. Yeah. So that is fine. But then, of course, we are interested in demonstrating entanglement-based QKD. So we need, in principle, entangled photons. So that, we are restricted to using either infrared or even telecom. I mean, that is also possible, right? But we don't really have entangled photons in arbitrary wavelengths as of now. So we are restricted to certain wavelength pockets, which are more commonly, possible.